Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
This show originally aired in January of 2016.
Hello, this is Mary Robson, host for Nature Now for the first week of the new year. I'll be joined by Dr. Catherine Glue, lichenologist at the University of Washington, for the second part of our interview on the lichen of the Olympic Peninsula. Catherine's research includes lichen associations with plants in landscape ecology. This has led her to explore lichens in Norway, the Russian Far East, Japan, and Europe, as well as the Olympic Peninsula. Charlie Fleischman will help out keeping this show engineered and reading observations. We couldn't go on air without him. But as always, first, the mystery sound. This animal lives by hiding. You may see a sign warning of its presence when hiking, but they are seldom observed. We'd love to hear from anyone who has actually seen one. And observations, what's new in the world? I was thinking of, since this is a new year, talking about the new, and when I looked at what I found, everything old is new again. And we'll start with the snow on the mountains. I have heard so many people say, oh, they look right. A very common comment of, finally, there is snow on the mountains. A sense of relief and even gratitude comes to me as I appreciate the snow cover on both the Cascades and the Olympics. Hurricane Ridge opened for snow sports, with 7 feet measured as of January 1st. Not like last winter's absence of skiing or snowshoeing, Janice Berger, interpretive ranger at Hurricane Ridge, said she never taught snowshoeing last year, but she has this year already. What we see now may change as months pass, but we will watch the snow cover with hope. Cliff Mass, of course, says the El Niño effect is more often seen after January 1st, and that we can expect weather drier than normal over the Northwest and reduced snowpack accumulation over the mountains. Looking at the crisp new snow cover this week, I don't want to believe this. The Dungeness River Railroad Bridge has opened. When I walked on it January 2nd, the bridge still wore cedar boughs laid on it during the dedication ceremony December 30th. That bridge is a new experience now.
The rebuilt section extends 750 feet, about 200 feet longer than the damaged one, which has been completely removed. Its materials, steel beams, and concrete paving blend well with the surroundings, even though they are so new. The old railroad bridge, 100 years old, now looks tattered and antique by comparison, with paint peeling on wood railings. Later in the spring, the floor will be surfaced with concrete to match the new section. Since the Dungeness River is in a floodplain at this spot, the new design allows more open space for flood debris to pass under. As the work progressed last fall, salmon continued to move up the river even during the construction, because workers set a temporary bridge to move equipment without disturbing the salmon. 108 pilings with creosote were removed, improving the future health of the river. A permanent addition to the Olympic Discovery Trail succeeded remarkably quickly, completed only 11 months from the flood event.
And it is a beautiful, beautiful bridge to walk on now. Finally, the first bird of the new year in my area, January 1st, it was barely light, but I'm outside in slippers hanging up the hummingbird feeder. I bring it inside after dark to keep the liquid unfrozen. Hannah's hummingbird, at first light, arrived to receive the feeder. The air was 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Hummingbirds drop their body temperature at night to help them survive, but they need food to warm up fast when they wake. They show us miracles. Now to our interview. We are going to talk again with Dr. Catherine Glue. Our subject on this one is winter walks with lichen. And I am thinking that lichens grow rather slowly, but having listened to Catherine, she speaks rather quickly and gets a lot in a hurry. And what I'm thinking of about walking with lichens or looking at them is Dr. Brodo said lichens are the essence of wildness. And that completely fascinates me because they're not going to be sold in nurseries unless they accidentally turn up on a twig. You have to get out in the world to see them. So, hi, Catherine, and welcome back.
Yes. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. You're here on Nature Now because Kate Dwyer met you this summer on the Mount Zion Trail. Were you seeking something special on that particular hike?
I was with a group of other lichenologists, and we were looking for interesting collections that maybe people hadn't collected. We did not get to the summit of Mount Zion. We were hoping to, but as often botanists do, you dawdle along the way, and sometimes you don't get to your destination because you're just fascinated by all the plants and lichens and mosses that are along the trail.
I was actually going to mention whether studying lichens, it sort of reduces the aerobic character of your walk.
Right, it does. And it's funny when you mention Erwin Brodo, Dr. Brodo. I remember one time being on a trail with him that he had arranged a field trip for lichenologists. And it was like a three-mile hike, and we were all at the trailhead picking around, looking at things, and he looked and he said, we're never going to get to our destination.
I think that's actually a positive characteristic.
Yeah.
I read somewhere that nearly 25% of all the identified lichens in the U.S. are found in the Pacific Northwest. That would be both sides of the mountains. Is this likely?
I don't know if it's as high as 25%.
Okay.
However, that being said, I do know that two of the areas in the world that have a large amount of lichens, one is British Columbia up in Canada, so that's part of the Pacific Northwest. That's one of the high diversity areas of the world. I don't know if it's 25%, but it may be if you read that. It could be. I'm not familiar with that statistic, but the other place that's very high diversity is New Zealand.
For goodness sake.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's an island, is it a sort of a relict population of things, or
yes,
they're okay.
So they've got lichens that you wouldn't see elsewhere.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Even though I'm just looking at the ones I'm seeing here.
Yeah, and I've got a colleague, Robert Luking, who's working in Costa Rica, and his specialty is lichens growing on leaves, and no one had done that before him, and so he's finding a lot of new species that are on the leaves of tropical and subtropical plants.
Are some of those leaves year-round leaves? They're not deciduous?
Those can be. Some of them, yes, some of them are, but eventually those leaves are going to die. So contrary to our usual thinking about lichens being long-lived, they've got to get out and reproduce before that leaf starts to die. And it's not like an annual leaf like we have deciduous leaves,
sure,
but eventually that leaf will fall off. And it certainly is less secure than being on a rock or a 600-year-old Douglas fir.
Yeah, I had been thinking about the fact that one of the things that lichens need, in addition to pure air quality, is usually some time to develop.
Yes, they do.
Isn't this an element of forestry where people are trying to reforest an area? You can't just throw a lichen at a little tree and expect to have it develop fully fast.
Not fast, but they can develop. Some of the transplant methods they're using in Europe are stapling, like the Lobaria you mentioned in the last program.
Right.
That genus, some people have stapled those to trees and had success with them surviving, which is interesting. It's like they're very sensitive to air pollution, but they don't mind being stapled.
I was thinking.
And sometimes people will crumble them up, put them on cheesecloth, and then attach that cheesecloth to the trunk of a tree. Up in British Columbia, there's a woman who's been working, I think her name is Catherine Eanes or something like that. She takes lichens and basically turns them into powder, mixes them with a water solution, and then just takes like a crane that puts her up high in the canopy, and she'll spray the upper branches with that lichen and water slurry, and has had success with getting lichens reestablished.
Many of them do reproduce from little pieces of themselves, correct?
Yes.
If something blew off, like say this is fungal, but it's fungal with the algal component and other things. So I've been thinking that if I were considering being a lichen, the quickest way to reproduce would be to break off a piece and set it down somewhere.
Right, right. And that's fragmentation.
Oh, okay.
And that's an easy way for lichens to disperse. They're not very good dispersers when it comes, just in general, with spores or fragments, they're slow. It takes a while for them mm-hmm. to blow from one place to another. When they're fragments, it takes a while to kind of move into an area. But eventually, they do find success and will reestablish in places. Even in clear cuts, some people now are, like in Europe and even here, some people will take fragments in various forms and try and reestablish them with the new forests that are growing up. It takes hundreds of years.
I was thinking with some of them, if you have a lobaria the size of the palm of your hand, you have a very old lichen.
Yes, you do. That's true.
I don't know how old, but certainly in decades. Somehow that's a very attractive characteristic. They aren't going to just rush around going zip-zip. They're going to sit gently for quite a while somewhere.
I have seen
a cemetery in Maine where someone, I suppose decades ago, this cemetery had been in use since 1700, that people had tried to scrape the lichens off the cemetery stones, which were mostly marble, but they tried to scrape them off, and you can see the place where they scrape, and then another lichen of the same size and shape has showed up somewhere else on the surface.
But it
takes a long time.
It's not being abused.
Right. It's, leave me alone. I think they feel they have an obligation to keep those things readable. Lichens, we were talking about a winter walk looking at lichens. There are some changes from summer to winter, yes? I mean, I think they're easier to spot in winter because there's less, there's less
the
other
change.
Vegetation.
You could take a picture of a lichen, if it's on a headstone, you could take a picture of it and come back in 5 years and it won't look much different. However, if you took a picture of a lobaria, the lung lichen that you were referring to, and took a picture of it in 5 years, you'd see a difference there because those kind of lichens, which we would call foliose, and the hairy ones, which are fruticose, do tend to grow faster than those crustose ones that are on rock or some kind of stone.
I always think that the lobaria looks a little bit like a piece of seaweed that you've taken out of a package that you're going to eat.
Yeah.
And maybe
or a piece of lettuce. That's the other thing. I think it looks like it's ready for a salad or something.
I suppose that people really haven't ever eaten lichens very successfully, have they?
Well, it depends. In some cultures, they have eaten them. In Japan, they have used them, and in China, they've used them in certain food dishes, like in soups.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen them rarely in salads, and not directly, not like at a restaurant that I've gone to, but in reading the literature, you know, if you talk
sure.
about, if you Google lichens and food, you'll get these pictures showing them. Oh, and then also Native Americans in Washington and British Columbia used one that sometimes people call the hair lichen or bear lichen or something. It looks like brown hair. And they have a special procedure for preparing it, and they have eaten that in the wintertime as kind of salvage food.
Uh-huh.
Other things aren't readily found.
However, we're not finding lichens on our list of foraging for edibles in the forest or the garden.
No, they have cell walls made of protein, unlike most plants have cell walls made of cellulose, which is what we use for paper.
Mm-hmm.
And lichens have cell walls, like most fungi do, made of a material called chitin. And it's hard for our tummies to digest. So,
well, it brings up the question of how can an animal like a caribou or a reindeer survive in a healthy way on lichen, which are more carbohydrates than protein. But apparently there's something in those what are called reindeer moss but aren't moss, that these animals can eat them and stay healthy?
Right, and they have special enzymes for breaking that cell wall down.
Ah, okay. Boy.
Which we do not have.
That's probably a good thing altogether. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have some favorite trails in the Olympic Peninsula for looking for lichen?
Anything that takes me up to the Alpine is going to be a favorite trail. So I did my research up in the Quilcene area on Buckhorn Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always a familiar one to me, and I enjoy that. And Elk Mountain, that ridge going east of Hurricane Ridge, Elk Mountain is mm-hmm. really terrific. Mount Townsend, I was just up there in September when I was on another day after the Mount Zion, and that's a fabulous place for looking at alpine lichen. So that's kind of, I'd say favorite is probably more my kind of interest.
That's
Mount Townsend, it can be a very challenging hike, as many people know.
Yes.
But it's well worth it to get up there and look at the lichens. And I think most people go up and look at the view, and I always tell people, just sit down and look at what you're sitting on.
Well, and one of the other things for hikers to think about is the splash of orange or the splash of chartreuse or the splash of bright red that people kind of think, gosh, who spilled paint up here? It's the lichens.
Yes.
Is that a chemical response? I know some lichens you identify by their chemical signal.
Yeah, and those are pigments that are made, and I don't think I mentioned yet that lichens are a symbiotic relationship between a fungus, which is about 90% of their volume is fungus, and then about 7 to 10% are either green algae or blue-green bacteria. And only in that symbiotic relationship do those pigments get made that are like the chartreuse and the yellows and oranges. If you try culturing either the fungus or the what we call the photobiont, which is the green algae or blue-green bacteria, you'll never see those pigments. So that's something that's unique to the symbiotic relationship.
It's pretty striking. I mean, it really makes a difference in how we feel about what we're looking at. Another question is, you work with the herbarium at the University of Washington. In this case, you are identifying specimens that are already there and providing new ones in the lichen world, or?
Yes, or sometimes just new locations. For example, the lobaria that you spoke of, the lung lichen, it's found throughout King County, yet we hardly have any representative collections. And so one of the things that I'm working on with some other people is getting more collections for King County, because it looks like that lobaria is a rare lichen in King County for us in Seattle, and it's not. It's just nobody's collected and put the specimen in the herbarium. So that's part of what we do, is just contribute to the county location piece so that people know where to find them.
Okay, and let's say that I had misidentified a lichen, which you told me earlier is extremely easy to do. Can I take a sample of my own and use the herbarium? How does that work for people who don't have a university association at the moment?
If you are a researcher and they prefer someone who has got research credentials as opposed to the public, but you could always talk to the collections manager, whose name is David Giblin, and ask him if that would be okay to go and look, and you could compare your specimen. But if you don't know the terminology for the morphology, for the structures that are on the lichen, then you might continue to misidentify.
Well, the other thing is that reading any book about lichen gives you a whole new vocabulary that you can use for something, but the words are too long for Scrabble. So
they are. Even though I've tried using them for Scrabble, nobody knows if I'm making a spelling mistake or not.
I think
sometimes the best thing to do is if you have a specimen and you want it correctly identified, probably the best thing would be to contact me or contact another lichenologist who's familiar with the more likely common specimens, which is what people pick up.
Sure.
Although I've got one friend, when I was up in the quill scene, I got one friend who just continually picked up things that were not fitting into the normal descriptions of the lichens that we all know. And it's like, stop collecting, Al. Yeah. You know?
But there must be something going on there.
Right. And so, and that's part of it, because there's some genera. And in this group that he was collecting vein lichens that are very variable, and I have a friend in Norway who thinks that these variations are because this particular genus hybridizes. And so then, you know, are you really talking about a new species, or are you just talking about a new combination of characters and that kind of thing? So it can get complicated.
Well, one of the things that you had mentioned wanting to share with us was the other part of your fascination with lichens, other than the fact that, yes, the air quality is something, fixing nitrogen is something, but there's more.
Yes, there's more, and it's the artful part of lichens. And one, I just love looking at rocks with lichens on them, because they're very aesthetic to me. It looks like modern art. But when I got out of undergraduate, I decided to start taking some art classes, and because I'd done so much science, and one of the things that I got interested in was spinning and weaving wool. And then I wanted to start dyeing it, and I was using native plants to do that, but they tend to be susceptible to fading in the sunlight. And back to lichens again, I was reading about natural dyes and saw that lichens, because of these compounds they have for making pigments like the orange and green and that kind of thing, makes them very color fast. Well, that seemed like a good one to me.
Yes.
And yet I had to know what the lichen was to know which one to select to get these colors. And so that was very fun to get all kinds of colors that were even stronger colors than I'd get with plants. And just along that line, Scottish tartans, many of the purples and browns and brown reds are from lichens. And
oh, for goodness sake.
People have used those dyes in making the tartans. So the tartans, the actual tartans, not only do they represent clans, but they also represent the plants and lichens that were found in a regional area. And so that's pretty fascinating.
That's
too,
completely that, fascinating, especially because the aniline dyes didn't come in until the 19th century.
Exactly.
And they were weaving beautiful tartans long before that. So
exactly. And the purples are really pretty special because prior to people knowing about purples coming from lichens, the only way you could get purples was using a rare mollusk in the Mediterranean. And here all these Scots people were getting purples, which were supposed to be royal colors.
I heard at some point that that was pretty hard on the mollusk population, too.
Yes, it was. It was.
Used them
so
at
I think
a great
that was
rate.
A nice relief. Of course, then what they did up in Scotland was over-collect the lichens and make the purple colors.
Okay.
Always get enthusiastic and over-collect.
We have almost finished this winter walk. Do you recommend one handbook for someone just starting to walk along with lichen?
Well, my favorite book I found out was discontinued. You can go online on Amazon and get it. It's called Lichens. Real easy title
just
to remember.
Just Lichens, huh?
And it's just Lichens. You can still find it there. It's maybe get a used one. And it's by a man called William Purvis.
Okay.
The other book I would recommend would be the McCune and Geyser book, mm-hmm. which is Macro Lichens of the Pacific Northwest.
I have that one, and it's very useful. He doesn't like
pictures.
To put a nickname on a lichen. Dr. Brodo
yes.
seems to like to nickname them, but McCune is very straight up about what's going on.
Right, and part of that was because when Ernie Brodo was working with Yale would not publish that book. My understanding was that Yale publication wanted him to come up with names.
Oh, for heaven's sake. So he was splashing along thinking them up.
Right. So Bruce McCune didn't have that restriction, but to my knowledge, being with
right.
Oregon.
So Macro State Lichens University. Of the Pacific Northwest and an out-of-print book called Lichens, which you can find online.
And last, of course, would be the Ernie Brodo book with Sarnoff and Sarnoff. Even though it's a big book, you can find that on Amazon sometimes for less than $100. And that's the Lichens of North America.
It's way too heavy. It's way too heavy to carry. It's beautiful.
I told you before, I have a friend who carries it into the field.
My gosh, it's got to weigh 15 pounds.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
He'll leave it in his car, but he does carry it with him.
Okay.
Yes.
Catherine, thank you so much. I feel as if
you've
really brought us some inspiration about a necessary and beautiful part of our world out here, and I deeply appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Great.
I think I'll go for a walk. Okay.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
The mystery sound is the cougar, Puma concolor, also known as the mountain lion. This is beauty in the animal world, a cougar. This animal, though one of the big cats, does not roar, but does a lot of vocalizing, including purring. They hiss and growl, but fairly quietly. A cougar does not want to be noticed. Staying hidden is part of their hunting technique. Their grayish or brown coats blend into the environment. They are known for their strength, agility, and awesome ability to jump. Their exceptionally powerful legs enable them to leap 20 feet from a standstill or jump 15 feet straight up a cliff wall. The cougar's strength and powerful jaws allow it to take down and drag prey larger than itself. They are the fourth largest feline after lions, tigers, and jaguars. The cougar prefers habitats with dense underbrush and clear rocky areas for stalking. The cougars of the Olympic National Park tend to live in the mountains and forests. It persists even at low population densities, and they leave signs because there is definite evidence of their existence. Territorial scratch mounds and tracks can be found on backcountry trails throughout the park. The population numbers in the park aren't known. The western cougar group numbers are described as stable by the Fish and Wildlife Service. One source lists about 5 cougars per 100 square kilometers in Washington. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for New Year's Week. Thank you very much for joining me, Charlie, and thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. We at Nature Now would like to wish you a Happy New Year and, as always, very happy trails.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is The Authority Song, performed by John Cougar Mellencamp.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.